It's my pleasure to welcome back a friend, an advisor, a collaborator, Dr. Maha Aziz, who's a professor at NYU, a person who's written a trilogy of books, and recently wrote an essay for the Time magazine, which I thought discussed the risks associated with the New World Order so well that I requested her to come back and talk to us about the research.
Sure. So, the last decade or so, I've been focused on global risk, which means the threats to our stability, what is going wrong, what could go wrong. We look at future trends. And as you said, I've been based at NYU as a professor and author. And one of the projects that I've led with my grad students at NYU and the crowd of experts at Wikistrat, which is the world's first crowdsourced consultancy, is this risk prediction project. So every year, for the last 8 years, in fact, in December, we meet online and we crowdsource what we feel will be the major challenges for the coming year. We also, in the last 4 years, initiated a project on shock events. What are the less obvious or less predictable risks that could come up? Which is what I think many of you may have read in the Time op-ed
Oh,
that.
rats, by the way. What an op-ed.
Thanks. I feel that from my perspective as an educator, as a social scientist, this framework of global risk is another way to understand the world better so that others can make better decisions. And that really is what motivates me to keep writing, whether it's in Time magazine or, as you mentioned, my trilogy of books. The first book, which we talked about previously, was Future World
Yes.
Order.
In
And then
Dubai.
yes, exactly. More recently, I've been wrapping up the part two and three of the book, but it got delayed as the pandemic evolved, and so I'm looking forward to sharing that in the coming months. And in the last couple of years as well, I've really, although I love to engage with my students and go to academic conferences, I've started to speaking to other types of audiences through various agencies. I spoke at COP27, for instance, and also at COP28. More on that later. Obviously, it was a mixed experience there. But also real estate investors in Finland and consultants in Miami. So I think there's no question that we are all very curious about what could be next, what is on the horizon. And I imagine that's the case for members of Network Capital. I mean, I'm an ancient millennial, and I imagine most of you are much younger. So I welcome your questions and feedback later. But I think it's even more important for your perspective to be added to the public debate. And I say this to my students as well, because people a lot older than us are scratching their heads as to what could be next. So any value added, any input you can have can be value added. I also am on the, you're very familiar with the World Economic Forum, Utkarsh, and I've been on the council, the Global Future Council on Risk, since 2020 as well. So it's been enlightening to get that perspective. But today I thought, let me share a little bit more about what we've been doing with this most recent project. And that, again, that also relates to the Time article.
That's right.
First of all, a big picture, I think it's important for all of us to be on the same page as to how we might appreciate how the world has evolved. As you know, at the end of the Cold War, there was a sense of consensus, a sense of clarity about the world and how to understand it, right? We knew that geopolitically the US was in charge. The US won the Cold War against the former Soviet Union, and that gave it the legitimacy to lead us on a global stage. We also know that at that point, democracy was declared as the best system. It beat communism, and that was the political system that all countries were supposed to adopt. And at times, the US government used different tools to encourage other countries to be democratic. We also were told in the post-Cold War era, in those early years, that globalization was the way to go, that this is the best way forward for all of us. It will uplift millions of out of poverty. And lastly, we seem to have for a cert for a few years anyway, a sense of shared values, the idea that we should all get along, we should be inclusive, the sense of liberalism, the sense of accepting the other, the
Right.
migrant, the refugee. And I think the problem is the post-Cold War era has been over for a while, which is why even before the pandemic, frankly, I would argue even before President Trump appeared on the scene, there was a question mark about these aspects of the post-Cold War era. And again, we've seen it since the Trump period, and we've seen it since the pandemic. We've seen that there's a question mark about whether, geopolitically speaking, is the US necessarily the lead power? And I'm not sure that enough of us have appreciated that this has been building for quite some time. And as we'll discuss, there are other countries that have and actors who have tried to step up. Secondly, in this post-Cold War era, we've seen that democracy is not working, and I'm not pro-dictatorship, but the bottom line is in most democracies around the world, we've seen that citizens have pushed back in what I've discussed in my work in the past as this recurrent crisis of political legitimacy. Citizens, armed with technology, perhaps, maybe that's the game changer that has facilitated this. They have been able to challenge their governments, their government policies, certain leaders in democracy, dictatorship, and mixed systems in ways that, we didn't really anticipate. Thirdly, again, globalization was supposed to work for all of us, but we've seen a policy alternative emerge in significant ways before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and it will persist, I imagine, in the coming years in terms of economic nationalism, right? And let's not forget this looming cloud of automation, tech-related unemployment that we'll have to contend with in the coming years. And lastly, I think the aspect of global risk that I'm not sure we fully appreciate is that we have had this crisis of identity, of values. Are we globalists? Are we nationalists? Do we care about the other? I don't feel we've really understood or appreciated this. And in the last decade of my work, I hate, it's upsetting just to have noted this evolution of hate, with different forms of extremism from far right to Buddhist extremism to Islamist extremism. And as I pointed out in the Time article, like, are we heading now for a new type of terrorist recruit that's more environmentally driven, that's fed up with the fact that governments and institutions are failing to make the progress that we need? And I think that's something to really keep in mind. And the COVID effect, the Ukraine effect has largely just exacerbated this crisis, this global legitimacy crisis with the end of the Cold War and this confusion geopolitically, politically, economically, and socially about where we are. And I think that's part of the reason in recent years we've been at a loss. We're not really the post-Cold War era, US leadership, that's behind us. Whether or not President Trump returns to office, frankly. So big picture, that's how I would encourage Network Capital members to really, that's how you should view the world in this post-Cold War era in these four facets. Okay, so
That's fascinating, Maha.
that's
It's a really interesting overview. I've already started getting questions from listeners. One of them is about epistemic agency, which we can perhaps discuss a bit later. But I want to
sure.
dive into the five main risks that you talk about in the Time essay, only because it structures the post-Cold War era really well. So shall we begin with the Middle East? Not necessarily who's doing well, who's not, or not necessarily from the point of view of ethics, but from international relations. How do you see that, and what are the implications for the region and for the world order?
This is a tough question. It's really it's it, you know, looking back, there were indications that this could happen, that there could be this unexpected assault, and we just missed the sort of the hints that this was on the horizon. I think a lot will depend on, well, the US election, right? In the event that President Trump, in the coming months, there's indication that he's heading for a victory, which frankly, a lot of the polls suggest that is the case. I think that's going to obviously become a major geopolitical flashpoint for conflicts, not just in the Middle East, but also with regards to Ukraine. Already, there's even during the Biden era right now, there is a concern that the government will not be able to push through the aid that Zelensky has asked for. So I think what we need to, if we take a step back, I think what we have to recognize is that the US is already a very overstretched power. In the event that we see one more major conflict, I don't know to what extent the US would be able to be engaged in the way that it might want to, or Biden might want to. And the obvious shock event or conflict that comes up is with regards to Taiwan, is this the year that China steps up and invades Taiwan, particularly in light of this election that's coming up in a couple of days? And I think that's something to keep in mind. We live in a world where we don't have clear leadership, plus the big powers, and this relates to one of the risks in our upcoming top 10 risk list. The idea that this is perhaps a post-superpower era that we are entering. This year, all the big powers are going to be dealing with major elections, which will potentially be very destabilizing, whether it's the US, the EU also has important elections coming up, India, Russia, and so forth. And we might raise the issue, and that's what we've tried to do in our upcoming top 10 risk list, that this could be a post-superpower era where because these superpowers are distracted with domestic issues or these two big wars that are going on in the world, that this could create an opportunity for the other, for the smaller powers, and for other types of players to step up. And I'll be honest, we have been raising this issue for a while, the rise of the non-state actor. I used to talk about this more in the context of the tech leader, the tech firm that is influencing geopolitics and politics in ways that we're not fully appreciating. And obviously the classic example is Ukraine. Elon Musk is, well, he is responsible for Zelensky's progress so far. If Zelensky did not have satellite internet, he could not have engaged with the world in the way that he did and rallied support. Similarly, Microsoft, as you would know, approached the Ukrainian government before days before the invasion and said, let's move all of your government data into the cloud. So we've already, even before, even in the last year, last 2 years, we've seen that the non-state actor, the tech firm, the tech leader are at times acting as diplomats unofficially or acting as agents of change geopolitically in ways that governments cannot really challenge. And I think that's significant. The other point I wanted to mention with regards to this post-superpower era that we might be entering, where power is dispersing. It's not just about the superpowers, right? It's about the non-state actors, as I said, the tech firm, the tech leader. But we've seen geopolitical swing states, and I'm borrowing the term that's been coined by Jared Cohen, who you must have heard of,
The global
formerly,
affairs at Goldman, right?
formerly of Google, now Goldman Sachs, and he coined this idea of the geopolitical swing state because the superpowers are burdened or distracted or too busy competing with themselves. You're going to see other types of actors leverage what they have and not necessarily feel pressure to ally with one superpower or the other. And just a simple example is a country like Ghana. They've discovered that they have incredible assets in this period when allegedly we're moving towards closer to a period of renewable energy and away from fossil fuels. They've realized that, wait a minute, they have rare earth minerals that can be leveraged on a global stage and potentially even compete a little bit with China's dominance in this area. And I think that's significant. So we should be, as we get deeper into 2024, we should be trying to identify these geopolitical swing states, countries that, they're small historically on the geopolitical stage, and yet They have incredible assets that can be leveraged. And ad additionally, I just want to mention that I would argue that any country that wants to be strong on the global stage going forward in terms of foreign policy, it's going to be less about nudging other countries promoting democracy. It's going to be more about offering climate funding, right, as a foreign policy tool. I think any power that wants to be relevant will have to think about this as a strategy. And already we see that. I think, people are not aware of this as much because it's not publicized sufficiently. We are so focused on COP28, COP27. But actually, countries like Scotland have engaged in leveraging climate adaptation, climate mitigation funding to countries like Malawi. They've given it to show that they are, despite being a small state, they are in a position to show moral leadership with regards to climate change. And I don't think we pay enough attention to these other actors, the non-superpower actors that are trying to really show that they don't need to necessarily ally with the US or China or other superpowers to progress. They have more independence and leverage. So it's a good time to not be a superpower in a sense. And additionally, I would also say that we've seen, as you know, an incredible drive by the Global South, right? Led by the BRICS. And this came up in the timepiece, this idea that more countries are realizing that they don't have to trade in using the US dollar, right? They can engage in their own currencies. And that dialogue did come up before the pandemic, but it feels as though there's a resurgence in that dialogue since the summit that happened in Africa a couple of months ago. And I think that would also be a significant trend to observe, these other actors that again are engaging in climate funding as a foreign policy tool, or acting as geopolitical swing states because they have rare earth minerals, or they're simply moving away from the US dollar in trade to show that, they have a different agenda now. There's less pressure in a post-superpower world to simply ally with one superpower or the other. And again, tech firms, tech leaders, I mean, we all know who the big leaders are. I would argue going forward in the coming year, we'll probably be more inclined to listen to Mustafa Suleiman about his views on
On
how
regulation, yeah, as you talk
exactly
about.
and exactly how the job market will evolve, how society will evolve. I mean, I know Elon Musk is perhaps criticized a lot for being quite eccentric, but Mustafa Suleiman seems quite, much more level-headed about where we are moving. And I think, again, power is dispersing in a post-superpower world. I think it's positive, but from the perspective of risk and instability, it could be negative, right? Because we're not clear. We just don't have clarity on who's allied with who. And so it's going to be a little fuzzy for definitely for the coming year, and probably for the coming, decade till 2030, till we suddenly wake up one day and have realized that, oh, this country is the superpower, maybe because of AI, dominance or AI weaponry or some other aspect of power that perhaps we've not even thought of yet. So that's one of the broad global risk trends that
Very important for everyone to understand. Just to summarize the multiple points that Maha mentioned, one would be that the US has retreated from its position of moral, intellectual, and of course, economic leadership, which still exists in forms to sort of an America First approach, which is parroted by multiple presidential candidates who say, I think America first, and everyone else also maybe figures in the equation, but this is different from American foreign policy earlier. US dollar is no longer the standard medium of exchange in many shapes and forms. Cryptocurrencies have come up. China has started asserting itself. Saudi, UAE, India are trying to form a different kind of an alliance, an economic alliance of using a different currency. And all of these will cause instability that will impact others. So the question on the Middle East, just some thoughts from my side. I think this, among other things, it also talks about the the relevance of non-state actors in figuring out what happens on the ground, same for Ukraine, and the way the issue gets resolved or not, how non-state actors engage and come together, the social networks they form, the kind of moral points of view they express, that definitely has a bearing on how everyone goes. And I think Maha might already know, but one of her students, who's a friend of mine now, is working on international foreign policy of tech companies. So the role of large tech companies is becoming very, very important. So again, like, thank you so much for laying it out so clearly.
Sure.
I want to talk about your COP28 and 27 experience, and you talk about a threat of climate terrorism and some of the discontentment with the COP outcomes. Do you want to talk us through that?
Sure. I mean, I'm not, I think there was a question regarding the UN, the relevance of the UN. I'm not, A, I want to say I'm not anti-government or anti-superpower. I think it would be great if we had clarity about everything and we had an understanding about who was responsible for climate and who's responsible for AI. And I just don't think we'll overcome that anytime soon. I think there's benefit definitely having attended. I spoke on the main stage last year at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, and what a venue, right? By the beach. But obviously it was, there was a sense of frustration till the establishment of the Loss and Damage Fund, right? That was historic. And as somebody, as you know, I'm originally from Pakistan, and I also earlier this year worked with a student. We co-wrote a piece on Tuvalu, one of the islands that is sadly sinking due to climate change. And there was definitely a sense last year with this Loss and Damage Fund at COP27 that we're making progress. And I was inspired as well, but that didn't last long, right? That sense of positivity or optimism or hope really didn't last because, in the subsequent months, we realized that most countries, including the big powers, including the US, they were backtracking. They were saying, we don't think we'll give, we probably won't give money. In fact, the climate envoy, John Kerry, last year said, the US and other countries have a responsibility to show moral leadership and contribute. Just before COP28, he said the opposite. He said, we're never giving money. So it was really frustrating. And if you look at the numbers, and I think I mentioned this in the article, I believe 700 million was pledged, and the UAE sensibly gave a lot of money, given that they were facing some backlash for hosting it as an oil-rich country, and the head of the oil company was also the head of COP28. But they were very sensible to give a significant amount. The US barely gave, what was it, 17 million or something like that. I mean, it's really upsetting. And I think I think it's safe to say we're not going to make progress. I mean, at the end of COP28, as you know, there was this decision to finally agree to move away, to start to transition away from fossil fuels. But that's by 2050. That's a long way away. So in the meantime, this year for certain, and this decade, we're going to have more climate events that will lead to more conflict. That will lead to more refugees. Nobody is taking responsibility, frankly, for climate refugees. They don't even have representation in international law. So I think we're not fully appreciating the near term. A lot of these discussions, these big summits, they're more long-term strategy, long-term policies, and who's going to help in the short term. So that is why in our work and in the timepiece, we thought about what's going to happen more near term in the event the frustration grows about the failure to tackle this obvious shared challenge of climate change. And so that's how we came up with this particular one to do with environmental related terrorism. I don't want to, and again, I want to be very careful about what I say. I'm not suggesting a young teen activist is suddenly going to engage in violence. I mean, there was a presence of young people protesting at COP27, COP28 in a
World Economic
respected way.
Forum, it happens wherever they
Exactly,
are. Yeah.
exactly. So I'm not suggesting they will suddenly one day be violent, but there's a level of frustration that's going to bubble up, continue to bubble up. And at some point, it's not inconceivable that we will see some sort of direct challenge to government or fossil fuel companies in a violent way. I think, frankly, it's inevitable. As I mentioned in the piece, certainly more activism, more pushback against ESG investing, more activist investors that are pushing companies to be more sustainable in their investing and in their products and so forth. We've even seen young people start lawsuits against governments to and against oil companies to stop what they're doing. But at some point, I think this is going to be inevitable. And the dangerous trend that we might see is that some of these legitimate activists will be scapegoated as potential terrorists or terrorists, while eco-terrorists are emerging on the scene. And there is some precedent. There was the I think it was the Earth Liberation Army. There were a few examples in the past, in the 80s, but that's what we felt, that this is in the realm of possibilities, though it's very hard to predict. The other element that could be very dangerous for us, and I do want to, I mentioned the startup in the US in the article, and I spoke with them. I'm touched base with them recently as well.
It's a,
Makes up.
I had read briefly about the technology, but I didn't know that it was already operational and
I was surprised as well. And so the big problem is if we don't have a UN-driven solution, if governments
Maha,
are
do you want to
still.
tell everyone what that problem and startup roughly is? They may not have read the paper.
Sure. So the basic idea is if our governments and other actors are not going to get their act together and we keep dealing with the effects of climate change, you're going to see a private actor, whether it's a startup like Make Sunsets or a private actor like a billionaire, try to hack the planet. And one type of hacking of the planet is solar geoengineering. And so this particular startup, Make Sunsets, has basically released balloons of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. And the idea is that that will reflect the sun's rays and that will cool the planet. And I don't want to suggest that I back this approach. I think the sense I've had from talking to reading about them, engaging with them, but also talking to journalists who specialize in this topic. And the sense is that this is a very small scale strategy that's being attempted, and the long-term effects are not clear. And that's the problem with solar geoengineering. It's controversial, right? If one country were to engage in solar geoengineering on a mass scale, if it's government driven, for instance, not just by a startup, but if it's government driven and done on scale, what if it has a spillover effect on a neighboring country? Or what if 2 years down the line, we have even more adverse effects of climate change? And I think that's the problem. And so the good news is that the US and the EU have looked into this, they've researched this, and they've thought about regulation, partly in response perhaps to Make Sunsets, this US-based startup, partly also because the billionaires of the world, particularly tech billionaires, have been talking about this strategy as a possible game changer, right? And George Soros, in fact, backed this. There was a press conference just before the Munich Security Conference in February, where George Soros, along with a British climate scientist, a well-known one, they talked about how they back this. And I don't know if behind the scenes he's now officially, putting his money towards this and saying this is because he's suggested that this could be a way to tackle the climate change that's being that's impacting the Arctic, right? Which is also a geopolitical flashpoint, given the fossil fuel, the oil and the minerals that are there. So I think the problem is this strategy might become inevitable by a private actor if our governments stay in this sort of this crisis of political legitimacy. They take two steps forward and five steps back, and they're not going to be, it doesn't seem likely that this will be prioritized. I do want to mention there's a book I always like to recommend regarding climate change, The Ministry of the Future. Have you heard of it?
I have, yes.
Yeah, so it opens with a major climate event. It's Global heating kills a million people, and then this particular government decides to, in the story, decides to, well, after criticizing the UN and the world for not coming together to tackle climate change, they engage in solar geoengineering, and I think it's really it could be a game changer for us, big picture, but it could also be a disaster, and we could be much worse off. And I think that's going to be a significant sort of shock event that we should keep track of as we are in our work. Yeah, I wish we could kind of I wish there was more discussion by government. Only the US and EU have discussed it in a sort of they released a report about it. But you know, the truth is, given we live in this crisis of political legitimacy in a post-Cold War era or a post-superpower era, the truth is anybody can try anything.
Anyone can try anything, and the private actors seem to be trying quite a few things. Some of them are working. We have already discussed Tesla and Elon Musk's personal impact, whether people like it or not, on the geopolitical world order, but also how strongly capital and boardroom dictates action. If you look at a lot of what, and this is not my term, of course, what people criticize as woke. I don't even know how that's defined, but let's just call what people refer to as wokeism. People are now connecting it to the boardroom by looking at
To the what, sorry? To the
the wokeism,
yeah.
WOKE. And again, I'm not pro or anti-woke. I'm just saying that if you do a deeper dive into where that agenda comes from some people, one camp argues that it's basically coming from the boardrooms of the large asset
Yeah.
management companies and who hold large stakes in bigger empires that dictates what people say. And the others believe that, okay, we seem to be powerless. So what do? We go on the roads, we sit there, we throw paints on paintings, we come up and protest. I think everyone is in the process of figuring out what to do. But I'm glad to a certain extent, at least people have learned to say the right things. That's necessary, but insufficient for action. And I think that comes across very clearly from what you've explained.
Definitely, definitely. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be an interesting year. I think the other risks that we've talked about in our work, that's coming up in our top 10 risk list, separate from the Time article, is of course to do with elections. This is going to be an important year. I believe over 70 elections, globally, and let's not forget this is the era of AI. We don't know to what extent AI, I mean, you would know best given your tech background, but we don't really know to what extent technology and specifically AI will help or hinder the election process. And that's going to be significant. I can only imagine how it might be leveraged here in the US and what that will mean in what will likely be a Trump versus Biden showdown in
Yeah.
November. So I think that's definitely something to be concerned about, deep fakes, misinformation, disinformation, etc. We also talked just, you know, even if Trump doesn't win, and again, he would not take over till January 2025, but the Trump effect is something that we are concerned about, right? This year, with Trump having a more public profile in the run-up to the election, you can be sure that there will be more hateful rhetoric that's spreading, sometimes inspired by what he's saying, triggered by what he's saying, and that potentially could have implications not just for domestic stability here in the US, but also it could be a rallying point for comparable extremist groups and far-right groups in other parts of the world. I believe it was the attack in New Zealand a few years ago, the individual who
The
in
Christchurch
Christchurch,
massacre, yep.
yeah, I still remember he had said that he was inspired by the far-right extremist groups he read about and heard about in the US. So one can only imagine to what extent we might see in this, again, a world where we don't have shared global values and we don't have real moral leadership, to what extent just Trump's return to the public space, what that will mean in terms of these hate trends, these extremist trends. And look, the reality is certain countries are going to be nervous about his potential return, and certain countries will be happy if he does return, right? Ukraine obviously is already dealing with concerns regarding a decline in aid from the US government. But you can be sure if Trump does return, that's going to be a significant change for I mean, it could end the war rather quickly if aid is pulled out and you know certain autocrats are emboldened by Trump's return. So you know, yeah. And another risk that I want to sort of highlight is that this could be another year of shock events again, because we don't have clarity on anything, on who's in charge, who's allied with who, on whether democracy is actually working, whether globalization will really withstand the shocks, supply chain shocks from different issues. This could be in some ways the era of shock events. And you know, in our work again, we've in addition to the ones we've pointed out for 2025 time horizon and the timepiece, we've talked about more near-term shocks that could be significantly you know, that could be quite destabilizing. One has to do with the EU, the potential for more EU exits. And the two countries we highlighted were the Netherlands and Italy, given the governments there. And we also highlighted regional conflicts that perhaps are not getting as much focus, but Venezuela is currently, you know, has had plans to possibly
Azerbaijan, perhaps.
and Azerbaijan as well, but Venezuela and Guyana, there's tension brewing between those two countries. The UK has sent you know has sent their support in this to destabilize the situation. Let's not forget the migrant crisis. Mexico, US, partly due to the Trump effect and partly due to this ongoing, perhaps mishandling by Biden in dealing with this issue. This is going to be an important campaign issue, and that will have regional implications for sure. And you know, another shock that, you know, we talk a lot about extremism and the different types of extremism, as I mentioned, eco-terrorism. I would also argue, as I touched on in the piece, that we might be seeing an anti-tech backlash that could lead to violence.
Techlash, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. We, you know, it's I'm a fan of technology at just as much as the next person, but for those who will lose their jobs, for those who feel they will be replaced by robots, and that anxiety of potential or chronic unemployment, the potential to lose our occupational identity. That can lead to significant, well, mental health crises. It can add to that, but it can also lead to a violent response. Will we see certain tech firms or certain tech leaders who keep telling us that life is going to change? You better get on board. You better learn this tool and this that AI tool. Could we see a significant pushback that leads to a sort of some form of backlash and a form of extremism, terrorism. You know,
The
it's easy.
Luddite movement in the 21st century. We are going to see all of that. In my dissertation, I am actually exploring this topic of what does achievement and automation mean in the workspace. In fact, we are having a philosopher, Sven Nyholm, to discuss this on 11th of this month.
Okay,
Precisely
excellent.
this. Maha, you do what you love. You write, what you care about, and you have a voice. And that's a very enviable position to be in. I mean, as a friend, I'm inspired, but 90% of the people will have to reinvent themselves in the coming 6 years. And that's not such an easy process.
I agree. I think it's really, I'm not sure governments are really in tune with this. And you know, even before the pandemic, we talked about automation leading to unemployment. That was discussed by many of the billionaires of the world, the tech billionaires, and their solution was UBI, right? They said, oh, we need to engage and push governments to invest in UBI. And there was one presidential candidate at the time, Andrew Yang, who I'm sure you've heard of, said that, you know, he wrote an entire book on this, and then he that was his platform for his presidential campaign. And he spoke to a lot of people in government, and they said it's a great idea, but we don't have the money. And I think, as per usual, governments are not fully appreciating the short-term pain that's going to happen due to these long-term changes. And we may again need to look to the billionaires, the techies of the world, to help facilitate this transition. I just at this stage, unless we suddenly see tech-savvy candidates winning elections, I can't imagine that we're going to have clarity on this. And I think, you know, the advice it's hard. The advice I try to give to my students is to, you know, there's no harm learning a couple of AI tools if, you know, if that's going to be the difference between keeping your job or getting a new job versus another candidate who doesn't have that capability. There's no harm. But I think that, you know, I think it's something we're going to be concerned about for the coming years. And it's not just about the younger generation. I think the older generation that maybe doesn't want to learn new tools, new technologies. It's going to be a very difficult period. And there's this economist at SOAS who coined this term, the precariats. And he was talking about people who would be left behind by globalization. That could be applied to the people who will fall behind in terms of the tech sector and the tech advances we're seeing, that they fall through the cracks and they sort of move from one temporary job to another, and it leads to this occupational identity crisis, which can bleed into this mental health crisis that we de are dealing with globally. And there's just not enough discussions about this. And it's going to be a difficult transition for sure.
Yeah, a lot of people listening to us might think that we are painting a very grim picture of the world, which is actually not what we are trying to do. The point of having a deeper analysis of risk is so that we can reinvent the set of possibilities. None of neither Maha nor I happen to be here to tell you to be very fearful and, you know, roll up under your blanket and enjoy your nap. Although you should, it's a Saturday night. Perhaps that's not such a bad idea. But the point of risk is to create a strategy that can help you, help your community, help your country, help countries collaborate with each other. Let's stick on jobs. I actually don't even think that AI is an avoidable subject. Like AI, for example, it doesn't have a standard meaning. Like, you know, using Twitter is also an AI application, and, you know, writing complex algorithms also is a version of AI. But people will have to work with algorithms and be accustomed to what philosophers call collaborative replacement, where the use of this is inevitable. Actually, now knowing technology is relatively easier as well because there is Copilot, there are various tools that can help people do the job. It comes down to, again, shock. How many shocks can you absorb and still function, which is risk. And adaptability, which is for me the most important part of your, you know, your body of work in this essay and your books. But I think the larger point that you make, I want to just like ask, is there any topic that you'd like to share, any concluding remarks where before we open it up for questions which are not recorded?
Sure. I mean, and again, I hate to have been so negative. Our work is about pointing out what is going wrong, what could go wrong, so people can prepare better, whether
Exactly.
they're, you know, in the real estate sector or in finance, and that's something to keep in mind, you know. And so that's something to
Yeah,
keep
the
in
point of risk is not to scare people, but to
mind.
make
To be
people
prepared.
prepared. Yeah, that's
Exactly.
insurance or anything else.
Exactly. And I think the silver lining of everything we've gone through, as we get out of the pand we've gotten out of the pandemic, we're out of the post-Cold War era. It's a new era. And I think that it's important to realize that there are positive agents of change. There are people who are driving change in ways that can benefit us. I just don't have as much faith in our governments to do what we need to do. But that's why it's great that there are policy entrepreneurs. There are, you know, tech entrepreneurs who are,
Academic entrepreneurs like yourself.
yeah, yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential. And look, technology at the end of the day is a tool. I don't buy the argument of some of these tech leaders that AI is going to destroy humanity. You know, I don't feel that in the next couple of years we're going to be living in a Terminator type of situation, right? I think there's potential. I think that, for instance, just one example, I remember reading how Mustafa Suleiman suggested that in a couple of years, you could use AI, give AI $100,000 or $10,000, and within a couple of months, they'll give you back 1 million. And if we could do that on a mass scale, we could potentially reduce poverty, right? If foundations were then investing in AI that can, beat the market, right? As they say, I think it could be very positive. I think that, as I touched on earlier, mental health crisis has been brewing for a while, but certainly since the pandemic, we can leverage robots and other forms of technology to tackle the plight of loneliness. I think, right? I think that's there's some obvious ways that we can leverage technology to deal with the challenges that we're dealing with. And I think that's something to keep in mind. The other aspect of tech that I think is so positive and can be a game changer to create opportunity, to reduce poverty, to increase online education. And I, separate from NYU, most summers I teach online a course on to diplomats, a course to high schoolers on global risk. But imagine if we could leverage satellite internet in places like Afghanistan to give young girls an opportunity to, despite the restrictions, to get an education. And in rural areas in Africa, in Pakistan, in many parts of the world, I think there are aspects of technology that will be a game changer to create opportunity to level the playing field. And I think that's where we should put our focus, right? In terms of
Absolutely.
trying to see a silver lining. There are concerns. We should be concerned, about digital inequality and so forth. But again, satellite internet could be the game changer. And it's not just Starlink. There are other opportunities in that space. It's not just Elon Musk and Starlink. So I think that's something to keep in mind. We going forward we'll be able to leverage tech as a tool once we get past the fear factor, right? I think it can be
A
a
ray
game
of hope.
changer.
Yeah, I think a lot
Yeah.
of the coming years will be filled with adventure, uncertainty, risk. And the whole point of communities, such as this one and others, is to provide you with the infrastructure to experiment, to understand, to learn from the best, and do what you truly care about. Because many aspects of people's jobs are bound to be automated. So you'll be left with a sliver of stuff that you have to do with the tools. You should all try to do it as well as possible.
Yeah.
And I think I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I think so. And I remember when I first met you, I guess in Dubai, I poured out all these risks to you, and then you explained that you're an optimist. And I was like, yes, I like the way
And
this.
so are you. Thank you so much, Maha.
I appreciate it so much. It's always great to engage with all of you.